From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Millions of pagers across the country stopped beeping and buzzing this week, the result of an errant satellite that turned its ears away from the Earth. The General Accounting Office issued a report finding that government computer systems are vulnerable to attack, and a group of hackers announced to Congress that they could bring the whole Internet to its knees with just half an hour's work. This hour, we'll ask just how fragile is our high-tech world? Are the bridges crumbling on the information superhighway? Why are we so dependent on technology? Why would you put all those millions of beepers on one satellite? Some answers and your questions coming up, so stay with us. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ah, summer. It's getaway Memorial Day holiday, and everybody's getting out of town this week. Things are slowing down and relaxing. Why, your pager hasn't even gone off for a couple of days now. It's so peaceful until you find out that your boss was trying to call you every hour for a few days straight, and that hospitals haven't been able to track down their doctors. And you're stuck at the gas station on the highway trying to pay for that gas with a credit card, you know? That won't work. And all because one satellite rotated out of position. Then to forget your troubles, you tune into the news and find that a government report says that the FAA computers, responsible for controlling aircraft travel, are vulnerable to attack, and that non-classified State Department information may be easy pickings for intruders. And then you hear a group of computer hackers testify before Congress that, oh, give them about a half an hour and they could easily shut down the Internet for days, or jam the global positioning satellites, or interrupt traffic for any number of computer services. Is this what the brave new world of digitized high tech is supposed to be about? Is the failed paging satellite just the tip of the iceberg? Is our infrastructure really this vulnerable? Are we too dependent on high-tech devices that could be all too easily shut down? What, if anything, can we do about it? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about this hour. We'd like to hear your ideas about all of this, so give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you'd like more information, just surf over to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And if you've been following the news this week, as I mentioned, you'll recall that testifying before Congress this week was a group of hackers. And one of them was, whose nickname is Mudge. And he's a member of the Loft Heavy Industries near Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he's on the line with us somewhere now. Hi, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Did you really tell Congress you could shut down the Internet in 30 minutes?
Well, Senator Thompson said in our written testimony, we have mentioned that there were serious problems at the protocol level with the way the Internet is set up, which isn't surprising. It's 20-year-old technology that's now being asked to do many more things than it was really envisioned to do, and it's become much more reliant upon for day-to-day operations than I think anybody ever really imagined. And we said, yes, actually, based upon some of the inherent problems, and we're not the only people who know about them, yeah, you could disrupt nationwide Internet service relatively easily.
How would you do that?
Well, without turning it into a cookbook recipe for anybody to just follow along, what it entails is confusing the different long-haul service providers. For instance, if you take, you can pretty much name them off, MCI, AT&T, Sprint, Alternet, PSINet, the different major Internet providers that talk back and forth for the backbone of the Internet. And you basically convince them not to talk to each other.
Hmm. And what about all these Internet servers and networks based on the Windows environments? Are they pretty secure?
There's really not much security out there on the Internet. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that are being sold as secure, there's no real watchdog organization. There's no consumer reports or underwriters' laboratories so that you can be ensured that they actually are meeting minimum requirements, or at least trying to practice due diligence. No, it's really it's like the Old West where, I mean, you can walk around and buy snake oil from people.
And how long would it take to break into these systems?
Some systems, it takes no time at all because they never really had a notion of security to begin with. It was, I mean, if you look at the Internet, it came out of an academic and research environment where the most important thing was moving and exchanging information and ideas, which is great, and that's what the Internet is really good at. As soon as you want to say, well, I'm going to exchange information and ideas, but I don't want to share it with everybody, well, that's not really how the protocols were designed. And nobody had really thought about that. So now you're saying, well, I'm going to start putting security on after the fact. This is, I'm sure there are tons of analogies for why you should think of something on the ground level and build it into the foundation if that's what you're going to use it for, as opposed to coming up afterwards and applying duct tape and bubble gum. I think one of the ones that Weld Pond, one of the other members of the Loft, had mentioned was when the Army wanted a new Jeep, they went out and they commissioned the Humvee. Which was designed and built completely differently from the ground up because they had specific requirements for it. They didn't go out and take, a Yugo and just say, well, how do we improve this?
Mm-hmm. So since it was never designed for security from the ground up, we're just basically putting Band-Aids on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And as long as people know that and are aware of that, it's not that big of a problem. But people are being told, hey, here's this great secure product. And it's not. I mean, when we did an audit of a relatively large auditing firm, we found that we were able to break into them primarily because they had put software in place that was supposed to increase their security, and it did the exact opposite thing.
Huh. Is this something that the average guy in the street could do, or do you have to?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, part of the GAO reports that Senator Thompson released at the hearings had mentioned that a government agency, a government group, was given permission to break into the FAA and other government branches. And in the report they said, look, all we did is we went to the websites, we went to the big search engines and plugged in hacking. We went to some places like rootshell.com, and we just ran turnkey scripts, point-and-click type things and got into all these places. They didn't have to even know how the scripts worked, which I'm sure is, something that CERT is going to sit there and hold up and say, look, you're just enabling people with these tools, but the thing is, you're also enabling people to protect against it as soon as you say, look, there are vulnerabilities out there. We're not going to try and hide it from you anymore.
So one of the objects of you folks is not to be the black knights but the white knights and point out where these inconsistencies and these Achilles heels are.
Yeah, I mean, the government has tried for a long time going the other route. I mean, and you have to try these things, and I think they learned that keeping the problems a secret and not sharing them with people ends up, they said, well, this is what we're going to try and do because we don't want it to turn into the cookbook examples and cookie cutter type executions here. Mm-hmm. So as soon as we find a problem, we try and keep that very close to the breast and not share it with other people. The problem is all the hackers already know the problems. The only people you're keeping it from at this point are the administrators and the people who are trying to protect their systems. So we're going out there and saying, look, the emperor has no clothes. Here are the problems. We understand that there are going to be some people who are going to be using the information that we give out for, maybe the wrong intentions or ideas. And at the same time, we realize there are a lot of people out there that can help protect their own sites and their own interests by the information we're giving. And one of the things we always try and do with the information we provide is we always try and offer a solution or a recommendation or ideas on how to protect against it. It's not like we're just saying, hey, this breaks everything, go use it, learn from it yourself. We're saying, hey, this breaks everything, here's proof of concept, and here are some recommended ideas that you can do to try and minimize the amount of damage.
Have you surveyed all the government servers and computers and found, basically decided how vulnerable they are?
Nope. Those aren't our machines, so we're not going to be touching them. Unfortunately, we've become pretty high profile, and going and poking around on other machines probably would get us in trouble extremely quickly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we actually set the Loft up in Boston, is we have a relatively decent-sized network internally, so we break into our own machines. And it's also much more advantageous for us because we control the environment. There aren't a whole bunch of unknowns. Like if Lotus comes out with the next version of Domino, and we want to basically see, because they promised there was some security enhancement in it, we want to see if that actually works. If you wanted to attack Lotus's site on the net, you don't know what other things are working on the machine. You don't know how everything's interacting. So you don't exactly know what you did, what the cause and what the response was. If you set it up internally, you control all the environment. It's just, you know, just like, you know, an engineer or a chemist or somebody in a lab would do. And you can actually see how the stuff is working. And it doesn't upset people as much because we're not banging on machines that don't belong to us.
If all these businesses are so vulnerable, and there's a quote in the Washington Times today that Will Pond said that that hackers can usually break into a Windows NT system in less than a day, and everybody's buying these systems. Why doesn't somebody do something? Why don't businesses do something about this?
Why should they? There's no incentive for them to write secure or, you know, robust code. As a matter of fact, it's more costly for them to spend the time and go in and do it. The software industry is in a really unique situation because they don't seem to have any sort of accountability or liability on them. I mean, if you read those software licenses.
Yeah, it says when you open this package, you give up everything.
Yeah. If you trust your company to work on our software and our software fails, you might get a, you know, sorry from us, but that's about it.
They have no liability on these.
Yeah, none whatsoever. Even kryptonite locks, those little bicycle locks,
mm-hmm.
they cost maybe $30 or so. They're not unpickable and they're not unbreakable. And the kryptonite company knows this. This is the same thing with car alarms. You know, a car alarm doesn't mean your car can't be stolen. It just raises the bar. And they will say, look, if somebody steals your bike and you're using a kryptonite lock, we'll give you back, you know, we'll give you up to $1,000 for it. You know, they're not saying it's impossible to steal the bike, but they're saying we trust our product and we actually worked on it and we're going to afford you some liability, and, you know, we're showing due diligence here. Microsoft, you know, companies throw millions of dollars at Microsoft for big site licenses, and they won't even say, yeah, we'll give you back a few million dollars that you lost there because your entire company went belly up. You were doing e-commerce.
Well, I know you have to go, and I thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thanks.
Mudge is a hacker with Loft Heavy Industries near Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he and fellow colleagues, other hackers, testified before Congress this week about how easily they thought it was that they could break into systems and telling Congress not because they wanted to brag about it, but not because they wanted to cause and wreak havoc, but because they wanted to show that these things can happen and sound the alarm to try to shore up some of these security breaches. Now, let me introduce my other guest because it's frighteningly similar to the almost to the story about the satellite this week when Mudge was talking about how it's a question of economics of why the satellite contains all those phone beepers on one satellite. It's cheaper to do that than to build a backup satellite at the same time. It sounded very similar to what he was talking about other businesses finding it cheaper and not to put security measures on their systems because it costs money to do that. Let me introduce my other guests. Rob Kling is a professor of information science and the director of the Center for Social Informatics at Indiana University. He joins us from WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Nice to be here.
Thank you. Tom Longstaff is the manager of research and development at the CERT Coordination Center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Thanks.
You're welcome. Michael Vadas is director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center at the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington, and he joins us from his phone in his office. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Let me just do a little, let me get a reaction to what Mudge was saying. Michael Vadas?
Yes.
Do you think he can do what he said he could do?
Well, I don't know, you know, about the claims of how quick they could do it, but I do know that we have a precedent back in 1988 with something called the Morris Worm, which was a worm that was launched by a fellow named Robert Morris from Cornell University that in very short order managed to shut down virtually the entire Internet as it existed 10 years ago. Really in less than half a day managed to shut down all email communications over the Internet because this worm infected a lot of the big computers that relayed messages through the Internet. And so that was possible then. The Internet has evolved considerably since then, but at the same time, it's not clear that the security has evolved all that much. So there are certainly vulnerabilities that could be taken advantage of by a skilled hacker.
Tom Longstaff?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Mudge was absolutely right on some things and maybe a little bit exaggerating on some other things. Let me just take it apart real quick. In terms of taking down the Internet, he's right. It's not especially difficult to disrupt service on the Internet. There are a number of problems with the protocols based on history. we kind of understand where those problems are, and it's extremely difficult to address them because they're in everything that you buy. But in terms of keeping the Internet down for several days, that's a tougher trick. Because as soon as the Internet goes down, you're essentially now playing a cat and mouse game with the people that are watching exactly for this kind of thing and who do understand what the problems are. So, yes, on the one hand, we are very vulnerable. On the other hand, taking things down for a long time is very, very difficult for an individual, you know, to do.
But how long would it have to be down to wreak economic havoc when the Internet becomes a real place to do commerce?
Well, today, it is a real place to do commerce, but perhaps not as relied on as it will be in a couple of years. Well, if you think about it, if it goes down for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, today that's probably not a tremendous amount of disruption compared to how mm-hmm. business works. I don't think very many people are going to go out of business when the Internet's down for an hour. Give it 3 or 4 more years, that situation will change drastically.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, there'll be some real money, as they say, on Capitol Hill affected. Once again, people are making airline reservations and doing commerce and trading, stock market gets trading, that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Then people will start probably sinking real money into the security part.
Well, and not only that, it's not just a matter of sinking money, it's how many different things are going to be relying on the Internet. How many other portions of our infrastructures, how much power, mm-hmm. water, gas, all these other things are going to start relying on basically the Internet as an underlying infrastructure.
That's an important point, if I can,
sure.
Michael Vattis, to underscore, and that is that we're not worried only about the Internet itself being shut down, but we're worried about people using the Internet as the vehicle to get into the systems that control infrastructures like the telecommunication system or the banking and finance system or the transportation system, whether it's air traffic control or railroads or something else. Those things rely on the Internet for communications, but they also, because they're connected to the Internet, that connection allows hackers to get into, for example, the telecommunications switching nodes mm-hmm. and shut down telecommunications service, or to get into banks and things like that. So if you were able to get into the banking system and cause system failures in banks or something like that, you can have a much more immediate and profound impact on the economy and on security.
Rob Klinger, is this a perfect example of future shock where technology has gone so fast we're not even sure how to deal with it?
Well, I think it's an example of story shock.
Story shock.
Why is Mudge claims a series of surprises? It's a surprise because many people have what I call a sense of lazy trust in a lot of technological systems, whether mm-hmm. it's being able to buy gasoline with a credit card at a gas tank or being able to use the Internet easily and assume that these are basically reliable and secure systems being taken care of by the experts. And while there's a good professional community of computer security specialists, by and large, the kind of refined sensitivity that they have to the risks of these systems and to the growing scale of interconnection and high coupling between them, that's not part of the public's understanding of new systems and new services.
Therein
lies a bigger problem because yeah. we're moving down the developmental path to more and more interconnection of systems which are normally pretty reliable but are also fragile, often underfunded when it comes to the technical and social support for them, mm-hmm. and where they're increasingly large risks on a larger global scale than we faced with systems in an earlier era.
When you have tens of millions of dollars, people, 30, 40 million people who depend on the pagers, and they're all on one satellite, couldn't you make a case for a class action suit by all these people who said, you know, when we signed up for this system, we thought that there would be we would assume there would be a backup system for something like this so we wouldn't lose 3 or 4 or 5 days of service. I mean, isn't that reasonable to expect that would be the sophistication of the system?
Well, this is Tom Longstaff
yeah.
again. Remember that the satellite systems, the way they've been up there, have been extremely reliable. We just don't hear about a satellite spinning out of orbit every other day, which means that the kind of backup systems that you're talking about aren't necessarily a whole nother satellite. It's exactly what they're doing now. They're moving bandwidth to other places. They're moving things around. It takes a little more time, but you wouldn't expect this sort of thing to happen. And as long as you have an isolated system, like, mm-hmm. you know, single satellite, some isolated control, then you can really keep the understanding of how frequently that's going to fail to a very small number. When you start interconnecting things, I think that's when you're really going to start to get a different story.
And you mean this could have been or will be a lot worse, something like this in the future?
I believe this should actually serve more as a wake-up call in terms of, you know, if this is the kind of thing that can happen when a single component has a random error mm-hmm. and spins out of control and can affect so many different things that people weren't aware of, you know, where are we going to get to when telecommunications is intimately linked into, you know, the computer networks and power mm-hmm. and so on and so forth?
Yeah, and when everything is connected at once, and it could be sort of like the brownouts that we had years ago, right? When one grid goes down, the next grid goes down. That could happen in the telecommunications industry.
Sure, and even worse, but what we call cascade effects, where mm-hmm. you have a small effect create a larger effect through an infrastructure, is no longer going to be limited to a single infrastructure.
But I would only add, again, this is Mike Battis, that this is not a future scenario. We are there right now. We have these vulnerabilities because so many infrastructures now have integrated information technologies into their command and control and communication systems. Gas and oil pipelines, for instance, already rely on advanced computer systems to control the flow of gas or oil through a pipeline. Electrical energy plants, same thing. Banks, same thing. And so because of that reliance on those technologies, they have vulnerabilities that they never had before. And so people who can crack into their systems and gain what's called root access, the same control over those systems that a systems administrator has, they could cause a tremendous amount of damage today.
Yeah, this is Rob Green. It's worth noting that there's been a historical shift in the nature of these vulnerabilities from more local to more global. 20 years ago, somebody broke into a computer system in Omaha, Nebraska. They may influence some activities in and around Omaha. Today, they could influence activities that are taking place elsewhere in the nation or even in the world.
Yeah, in fact, I absolutely agree that we've got those problems in the interconnections now. The only difference between today's state and a future state is today it would take a significant coordinated attack to really keep the interconnections and keep the systems down as long as you would need to. But we're automating things faster all the time. So what is difficult today could be much easier if we don't start doing something about it very, very soon.
We're talking about the vulnerability of our new high-tech infrastructure around the world this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. And it also shows the vulnerability of satellites, doesn't it? I mean, militarily speaking. How much do we, you know, if you wanted to disrupt the whole government or international scheme, you could just take out a satellite.
And what's especially worrisome about that is that the plan for air traffic control is to move entirely to a reliance on global positioning satellites to handle air traffic control. But if the satellites themselves are vulnerable, there are obviously problems with that plan. So we need to make sure that security is at the forefront of the designer's mind when they're designing the GPS.
Yeah. This is Rob Klink speaking. For over 20 years, I was a professor of computer science before I moved to a school of library and information science. And one of the things that's worth putting on the line very directly is the relative difficulty and infrequency with which computer scientists are taught much about safety engineering or even computer security. It's a specialty topic which is taught in a few of the programs around the country. And it's not part of the working lore of many practicing system designers.
Yes, in fact, that exactly leads to some of the existing problem we have with developing software today. People are not coming out with a good understanding of how vulnerabilities work, how they take place in software, how to prevent them. So in every generation, we seem to reinvent all of the problems in software that we've ever created.
Let me take
it's worth noting.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, it's worth noting that a lot of the system failures happen not just because technologies fail, but they're social systems in part also, where there are technicians who are supposed to be watching meters or turning on a backup system, and there are human failures as well. And when designers don't take account of how people work with these systems to make them social technical systems, mm-hmm. The problems of risky design are even more likely.
That was one of the problems with Three Mile Island, wasn't it, when those systems failed? There was a human component there watching what was going on.
Yeah. I have to build on that as well, because we're in a situation now where we have spent the last 20-some-odd years making systems extremely easy to use. You can take a system out of the box, put it on your desk, turn it on, and it just runs. But we have not really made any progress at all in making them easier to secure or administer. That still is basically requires a great deal of special knowledge.
And it requires money to do that. And that seems to be one of the messages coming out of here, is that businesses, you know, try to increase their profits to the point where maybe security is being compromised. Would you agree with that?
This is Rob Kling. I certainly would. I mean, you have to make many shifts in frame and worldview in order to be able to engage these problems. You have to move from a view of discrete technologies like pagers or PCs to systems. You have to move from systems that are working well to systems with failure modes, something that's understood in safety engineering. You have to begin to move to socio-technical systems with failure modes, something that's not well understood by many people who are focusing on security as something which is only in the software. Then you have to shift your focus to interacting socio-technical systems, and then to highly coupled into socio-technical systems. Those leaps leave a lot of people behind, and I'm talking about technologists and managers and so on, and their eyes glaze over. They feel uncomfortable with each one of those big shifts of worldview that I just identified.
And you know, the other point, Ira, you raised the idea of a lawsuit. I think security is only going to become an important consideration to the manufacturers of hardware and software when the market demands that they do it. Right now, you know, how many times a day or a week do you have some failure when you're sitting at your desktop, and what do? You reboot.
Right.
Because it's just sort of par for the course that you're going to have your computer seize up for a couple of minutes. But until we start thinking of those sorts of failures as things that we won't accept, or more importantly, that security holes are things that are unacceptable.
All right.
Demand.
I'm gonna have to break in and take a quick break, and we're going to take that break and come back and talk lots more about security. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from National Public Radio. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. In case you just joined us, we're talking about all the mishaps and the security and the fragility of our high-tech infrastructure this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Let me introduce my guests. Rob Kling, Professor of Information Science and the Director of the Center for Social Informatics at Indiana University. Tom Longstaff, Manager of Research and Development at the CERT Coordination Center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Michael Vadas, Director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center at the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington, D.C. And resurfacing after a little break for a half hour is Mudge, our computer hacker, a member of Loft Heavy Industries near Cambridge, Massachusetts, who testified before Congress this week. And our number, 1-800-989-8255. Mudge, you've been listening?
Yes, I am.
Any reaction to the discussion so far?
I think it's going pretty well, actually. I found a little bit more time in my schedule than I thought I was going to have.
That's great. Well, we're going to go to the phones because lots of people have phone calls, and this really has been a hot topic. Bill in Irvington, New York. Hi, Bill.
Howdy. I'm down there at the blunt end of the pencil. I'm a systems administrator. I'm the guy that management yells at when the systems go down. For whatever reason, and I'd like to make a couple of points, a little less theoretical than some of the discussion that's been made so far. And I'm going to make my comments a little stark and leave out some of the finesse that's necessary when you actually get down to do the work. At the moment, management requires me to manage basically a big mess. We have some Unix systems from various vendors, and we have various Microsoft Windows systems from various vendors. And I'm going to say something that's very blunt in the interest of your listeners. The Microsoft systems, by and large, have no security whatsoever at all.
Which systems are you talking about?
Well, I'm trying to finesse that. But basically Windows systems. Windows NT is the only system from Microsoft, the only operating system from Microsoft, which even pretends to have any security. And the way Microsoft is handling the situation, or rather not handling the situation, it's a pretense. They don't fix things very quickly. even when they know about them, and they just throw up their hands and say, well, we weren't going to do anything about this in other cases. In general, for your listeners, any system, any network involving Windows 95 or Windows 3.1 systems networked to a Windows NT system is insecure and cannot be made secure because Microsoft won't take any steps to fix it. But that's one of my points. The second point is has to do with the socio-technical issue which has been brought up. My management, the people who tell me what to do and pay me to do it, do not and will not, no matter what I say, take security seriously. They will not allow me, this is a technical problem in some ways, and it presents some technical solutions. And when you put technical time into it with a particular direction, you can get improved security.
But why?
Management won't do that.
They think it happens someplace else, or they don't want to spend the money on it.
Frankly, I don't understand their thinking. I don't think there's any thinking. I don't think there's any thinking to understand.
And you think this is common across other industries?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is, every time I talk to my peers, I get the same story. You know, we got an advisory from CERT. You got a CERT person there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We got an advisory from CERT about a bug in, SendMail. SendMail has lots of bugs in it. This is a Unix program which is responsible for handling most of the email on the Internet. It does the forwarding and the backwarding,
right,
and all the mail delivery stuff. It's a very, very complicated program. It's a tour de force. Eric Ullman, who wrote it, deserves all sorts of credit. But nonetheless, it's got all sorts of bugs. There's a new version out which is supposed to be better. Anyway, we get a CERT advisory that there's a new bug in SendMail, and it's in the so-and-so and so-and-so. So I go to my management. I say, look, we've got an advisory that there's this bug, and I'd like to go fix it. I figure it's probably going to take me most of an afternoon. Nope, can't do that. Nope, can't. You got to install those new systems over there in, you know, that other office.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 18 new Windows systems in.
Mm-hmm.
They won't take it seriously. The problem, in one respect, the problem is very seriously that management has got its head buried in the sand, and won't let its technical people, like me, do what is possible to do. And there is a great deal of sloppy installation and sloppy manufacture of default settings as the systems are shipped and all of that. There's a great deal.
All right, let me get. I see you're a little steamed, and that's rightly so. If I had to take that,
yes.
let me give you a chance to cool off. And
sure.
Rob Kling, how do you? Or Mike, or Tom, or
Mike. Rob Kling, I think that this story is unfortunately all too common. One of the things that's part of the larger story about computerization in the United States is the computer system should be cheaper. And one of the things that social informatics researchers and some industry consultants who are steeped in social informatics find when they look at systems use in practice is that either the costs of maintaining even PC systems can run in an industrial or commercial environment $10,000 to $20,000 per workstation per year. Well, that's a lot higher than the seeming purchase price of a few $1,000s.
$10,000 to $20,000 per
computer. That's right. Those
computer
are Gartner contract numbers. Yeah. Per computer per year.
True.
As a consequence, many managers try to keep their costs down, and one way to do it is to have fewer system support people. One person supporting 50 or 60 PCs in an organization is common, to have people who are less well trained.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of this orientation that computing should be cheaper rather than better but more expensive, there's an incredible system, I would call it systematic, but commonplace is more accurate, undercutting of the support structure for computing in many ways. And
well,
it influences security practices, it influences training, it influences many aspects of the ways that people work with computing in their and telecommunications networks in their daily workplaces.
Right. I mean, as Tom Longstaff, I've got to also throw in that even when you have enlightened management, and we actually do go to places that have some enlightened management, even when you do run into a few of those, they'll sort of shrug their shoulders and say, but you know, it's just not cost-effective to do the right thing.
So don't you think that if a server company, you know, be it Microsoft or Apple or Unix or whatever, came along and said, you know, our server software is really secure, wouldn't that be a selling point with the bill with you and other managers there who have to take care of this stuff?
Well, it's complicated because every vendor varies in their commitment to this sort of thing. None of them are truly committed, but even if HP said our HP UX system that we're now shipping is really secure, it really wouldn't matter. They can't make it secure for my particular or your particular or his particular environment. It requires, and regrettably, the software industry has not solved this problem, and probably it is insoluble in principle. It requires adjustment locally. I have to adjust it to fit into my addressing and my network. Mm-hmm. I have to, et cetera.
Well, Mudge was saying it's just it was actually built into the system to be not secure.
Well,
right, then it has to be bandaged on afterwards. But, one of the things I'm hearing out of this, I don't see just in the computer world. And I was talking to Bruce Schneier, who's a very well-renowned cryptographer in the United States, and he has a really nice analogy, which is everybody wants security and nobody's willing to pay for it. Because as soon as you go to the grocery store, I don't know if you've ever seen those places where they say, give us your personal information and we'll give you 5% off your current grocery list. And everybody says instantly, ooh, I'll save $2, here's my personal information. Yet you ask them outside of that, do you value your privacy? And they say, yes, definitely, privacy is of the utmost importance to me, and they'll throw it away for the smallest little thing. Well, you see that not only in the computer industry, you see that in everywhere. And what Bill was saying, and Bill, I didn't think you were going to say they had their heads buried in the sand. I thought you were going to say they had them somewhere else.
Right.
Is you see the companies, every company will market it as secure because they know that gets the manager's attention, because the managers are going to say, great, well, Bill and everybody's been complaining about these problems. We'll go buy them that quote-unquote secure system. But they haven't done anything other than get the marketing group to slap the title secure on it.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's even worse. We have a marketing intelligence out there that says the world wants a silver bullet solution. The world wants you to label your product secure.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter if it is secure or not. What matters is that you make people believe that you've solved the problem.
Yeah. My sense is that in the discussions about new technologies, one of the things that really does a lot of damage is the word solution. We don't have solutions in most cases. What we have are resolutions, fixes, improvements, enhancements, but not solutions. And we live in a world in which maybe getting pretty good security rather than somewhat decent security would be in advance.
But Microsoft isn't even giving tools, let alone solutions, in many cases. Oh, well.
Who wanted to jump in there? I missed somebody. But who should, when the World Wide Web was set up, there were people who were coming up with standards, the World Wide Web Consortium, whatever. Should there be someone overseeing standard then for security, and everybody would agree to it and incorporate it into their system?
Unfortunately, Ira, we've tried this single model before, whether it's a government or a single consortium or somebody standing up and saying, we will define security, but it's inherently a distributed problem. It's inherently just what Bill said. It won't work in my situation. So we need solutions that, sort of approach security in the same way that we've approached ease of use. We've made systems that are easy to use in a myriad of situations, but we just have not made security the same way. And there are very few efforts even going in that direction today.
Michael Vada?
Yeah, I was trying to make the point earlier that I think as a result of all these factors, it's not going to happen until the market demands it. And unfortunately, the market may not demand it loudly enough or strongly enough until there are some really significant failures that have a real monetary impact on people. And that is unfortunate because I think there are enough people out there who realize the problem, but as your first caller said, the systems administrators may realize it, but they can't get the people who control purchasing power to invest in security. And that's what's got to happen, because we can't impose security solutions on industry. It has to be market-driven.
Let me go to the phones to Vance in St. Louis. Hi, Vance.
Hi. I've been listening to the conversation, and it seems like there's a big elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, which is since we've been talking about infrastructure, if you'll allow me a somewhat naive analogy, look at where the highway system was in this country before there was any sort of government coordination. And I know we don't like to talk about government because you get into encryptions and the idea of, the free marketplace, but I've got to ask, when you get something this complicated, can we really avoid some sort of overriding body that's going to impose some of the absolutely necessary things that need to be done?
Well, let me respond to that briefly. I think he's absolutely right. It is going to take even some significant government involvement, but I just don't think that even the government alone is going to solve this problem. It's going to require private sector cooperation with the government. And that's something, I mean, that, you know, talk about your elephants that you don't want to talk about. You've got to have infrastructures that are willing to work together to talk about where the problems are.
Well, one of the big ways the government used to do things like this and still operates is because it's a giant vendor. It buys things, and it decides it's going to pool all of its vending in one pot. So it says if you want a contract from the government, you have to satisfy certain demands, and that creates, you know, the product that you're looking for. And once the product is there, other people latch on to it. Isn't there something like that the government could do, you know, through its buying power?
That sort of standard for federal purchases exists right now, but there's even more that the government can do. And I think your show being on today is really timely because the president this morning in the commencement address at the U.S. Naval Academy announced a major new initiative to protect critical infrastructures and the systems they rely on from cyber attack, whether it's from individual hackers just testing their skills or from hostile foreign governments trying to attack the United States through the Internet or through other cyber means. And there are a whole host of initiatives that are part of this program to increase education about the need for security, about ethical practices for kids learning how to use the Internet, setting up new government structures, including my own organization, to try to gather information and provide warnings to people about vulnerabilities that exist out there and about potential threats, either from groups within the United States or outside who may have hostile intentions against not only the U.S. government but against U.S. companies.
I have a quick question, and it involves Internet commerce. Does anyone on the panel think that the government should be warning companies that advertise security and advertise that purchases and things like that are absolutely secure on the Internet, that should the government be stepping in and saying, look, this isn't true? I mean, we have a trade commission, and should someone be saying, you know, not so fast?
I think that should, this is much here, I think that should definitely fall under some of the standard common law that's already in place, some of the Better Business Bureau. I mean, you don't necessarily even need a Food and Drug Administration to come out and verify the security so much, just as common ethics and business practices would say, I can't sell you, you know, a Diet Pepsi and have you believe it's going to, you know, cure cancer here. I mean, it's just an outrageous claim. I wanted to briefly contact on what Ira brought up about the government proposing standards and the industry would follow, and that might have worked a few years ago when the government was still the, you know, almost the sole purchaser of the large high-tech contracts.
Mm-hmm.
But they're only a very small percentile now, and the government can come and say, you know, you have to meet these requirements to sell them into the government market. And, you know, big businesses like Microsoft and Sun Microsystems will sit there and say, well, if we don't do that, you know, we lose 2%, but we make the other 98% of the commercial place happy. It's just not financially viable for them to be defining the standards at this point.
All right. Well, let me just remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from National Public Radio. Go ahead. Finish.
Okay, Ira.
Yes.
Tom Longstaff. One of the things that I want to also, you know, to add to that, I actually think what the presidential directive and some of these directions are actually going to be right on, because the government can't do it through purchasing power these days, but it can do it through distributing the expertise to right where it is. We have the FBI Center, which is just the right place for supporting the investigations and the dissemination of vulnerability information and that sort of thing. We've got private organizations like my own at the CERT Coordination Center that can help with some of the technical work with the victims.
Mm.
We've got Commerce Department that's going to focus specifically on some of the financial
measures. But let me bring up a topic we haven't talked about that's also, I think, crucial in the few minutes we have left. What about the hardware itself and the positioning of the hardware, the orbiting, the satellites? I mean, are these things all part of the infrastructure that are breaking down?
This is Rob Kling from Indiana University. I think one of the things that happens in these kinds of discussions is there's a lot of focus on attacks from terrorists, hackers, and so on. And these are legitimate. They're dramatic. But they get to be overdrawn because they leave out the kind of normal accidents which led, for example, to the satellite falling out of orbit.
Do we know why that satellite, what happened to that satellite this week at all? Does anybody really know what happened?
Nobody seems to be speaking about what actually happened.
I mean, could it have been some space debris that hit it? Something.
It's possible that some space debris hit it.
But go ahead. Make your point. I'm sorry.
But my main point is that the issue of system reliability and infrastructure reliability is a lot larger than hackers and crackers and terrorists and security, that it includes other kinds of system breakdowns and failures, and that, that we have to really keep our mind on this larger landscape of system risks that are not going to be addressed by simply solving. As difficult as security issues are to resolve, that's only one slice of the issues that we address. And that's, and this larger canvas has got to be on the table as we begin to continue to computerize on a large scale key and critical services in the society.
Yeah, in fact, it's going to be even difficult, I think, in the future to determine what was an accident and what was on purpose. I mean, we've built such a complicated system, and we're making it more and more complicated every day, that the distinguishing between a failure and an attack is going to become more difficult all the time.
Let me go to Ernest in Seattle. Hi, Ernest.
Yes, morning. I wanted to ask a question that hadn't come up about we were taught always to modularize our software so that the various problems could be isolated to a certain section, extract and attack directly. And I find it very fascinating today we have Microsoft arguing a legal case that because they haven't modularized their software, their new systems, Windows 98, they cannot separate out the browser from the operating system. And I haven't heard that brought up yet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Are we actually creating then our software to be more vulnerable then because we're not doing what Ernest said there?
This is Mudge here. One of the things that is extremely important and we saw a long time ago in the Multics operating system is compartmentalization of different components and how the operating systems work. Mm-hmm. And there was a – as soon as you really – and this was one of the reasons that the Multics almost went the way of the dodo there – is that when you really start to pull security into it and modularize things up and compartmentalize, it becomes much more complicated. It becomes a little bit more difficult, easier to make mistakes in how you're configuring things, and it doesn't end up taking it off. You know, you make it as simple as possible and insecure as possible, and that's what the public wants to use.
Mudge, do you think in the closing minute here that things can be made more secure? I'm sure you do, but as secure as you think it should be?
I actually was asked that same question over at the Senate, and the answer I think is yes. You can raise the bar, and I think that's what you really need to do in order to separate the signal from the noise level. Because right now the signal is completely buried in the noise level of all the silly hacks that are going on out there. The regular system crashes from insecure programming, there just need to be incentives for the companies to help do this. There needs to be incentives to help educate people to understand what they need to be protecting against. It's definitely possible to raise the bar, and that's what I think needs to have happen. But it's not going to happen from groups like CERT. It's not going to happen from groups like Loft. We can push as hard as we want to. It's got to come from the corporations that are spending the money that are, you know, fueling the vendors.
All right. Thank you very much. We, as always, unfortunately run out of time. Let me thank my guests, Rob Kling, Professor of Information Science and Director of the Center for Social Informatics at Indiana University, John Longstaff, Manager of Research and Development at the CERT Coordination Center, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Michael Vadas, Director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center at the FBI in Washington, and also Mudge, who is a hacker and member of the Loft Heavy Industries near Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you, gentlemen, all for joining me on this holiday weekend.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. On Monday, join Ray to talk about the Japanese economy, the second largest in the world, and its faltering. Join Ray and his guests on the next Talk of the Nation for a look at the cause of Japan's financial woes. Rich Rary is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Irene Trudale here in New York, Mike Paskish in Bloomington. Thanks to computer guru Rick Jarrett, Bob Boylan composed our theme music. I'd like to wish a happy centennial to the Washington Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., 100 years old this year. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007, or surf over to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where all references we made to in the hour, we'll have them up there by the end of the day. So if you missed any, you can just log on there and click on those references and find them. I'm Ira Plato in New York.